listened to every single podcast on oneofus.net. What do I do now?
Well, first of all, how is that even possible? But secondly, I think I have a solution for you, Chris.
There can be no solution, Brian.
There is a solution, and that solution is our newest sponsor, Audible.com. Guys, if you haven't tried Audible.com, now is the perfect time to do that. We're talking about content that includes over 150,000 audio programs. We're talking about books on digital, audio dramas, broadcasters, magazine and newspaper publishers, all the greatest stuff you can possibly imagine in one place just for you.
Okay, that actually does sound pretty good.
Doesn't that sound great? And you know what? I'm going to make it sound even greater, Chris, because they are officially, Audible is officially one of our sponsors here at oneofus.net, and as a special gift to you guys, Audible is giving away a free audiobook. All you have to do is click on the link at the bottom of this page, or you can go to audibletrial.com/oneofus.
You mean to say that by clicking on audible.com and downloading their free book, they make sure by listening to that audio that we keep making more audio as well?
That's right, and the cycle continues.
Welcome to Geeks at Large. Thank you for joining us again this week. And my name is Taylor, and I am joined by Neil.
Mad Max, Mad Max, I saw Mad Max.
Now, we're going to probably start the episode with that song, RGD2.
Yeah, no, or we could, like... We don't even have to use this. That could be a part of, like, you know, just like me singing over it. Mad Max, Mad Max, I saw Mad Max. I was glad Max, not so sad Max. Mad Men. Go see Mad Max. It's so good.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, we're not going to talk about Mad Max. We're going to talk about Mad Men.
Well, we're not talking about Mad Max? Oh,
no.
Fuck. That's right, because they both start with Mad.
Yeah. I wonder if, like, years ago when they decided to, like, start Mad Max, Fury Road, they were just like, we have to coincide with the, with the finale of Mad Men. We just
Mad
have
Men,
to.
Fury Road.
Mad Men Max. Mad Max Men.
Mad Max... Mad Maxi Padman.
Mad Maxman. Cue like 90s X-Men theme. Put it in a
I actually was humming the original X-Men theme, the original animated X-Men theme to Steven this past weekend, and he didn't recognize it, and that really blew my mind.
What? How did he not recognize it?
X-Men, X-Men,
oh, that
lead
one?
The way, lead the way.
Yes! Yeah, like
he didn't recognize it.
Yeah, like, oh my God. That was Kitty. Like, that was Pride of the X-Men.
Yeah,
Pride of the X-Men. Because it was just a pilot. Come in your way. I've used that Magneto several.
Yeah,
I think in listeners, if you want to hear the song, go to I believe it was our X-Men Days of Future Past review, which is Days of Future Unemployment. Is the name.
And it's still a year later, and it's still more up than ever.
Yes.
I'm crying on the inside.
I'm dead. On the inside.
I don't feel things anymore.
But speaking of feeling things, we're actually going to talk about... This is actually being recorded pretty soon after, but we wanted to talk about the Mad Men finale, and we wanted to talk about Mad Men. So we're kind of going a little off of our usual formula. I know with Geeks at Large, we're kind of focusing a little bit more on our professional careers and stuff like that, and talking a bit about that and tying that into subjects. But shit.
I feel like that's relevant. I feel like that, like, career stuff is relevant today because of how Gmail completely fucked me over.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry about it too.
Yeah, here, Google, put that in your $1 billion wallet.
Should I even say what it is? Should I even say it?
No, because you're gonna make everyone else sad. We'll make it sound less awesome than it was. Like you had to interview Carrot Top or some shit, you know?
I'd still be okay with that.
Really? Like, well, like, he did do chairman of the board.
Actually, that was what I was going to bring up is, you know, like, if I ever had the chance to interview Carrot Top, I'd be like, hey, man, I really enjoyed Carrot. I really enjoyed
Carrot chairman of the
board. He'd be like, oh, wow, thanks, man. And I'd be like, yeah, when I was 8.
And then he'd just be like, oh. And then he'd just play like, when. And then we cut to like, but it's like Carrot Top falling from the building with all the ads. Like, it's just the same opening, but with like they poorly photoshopped like a red wig on top.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking of. Like, can someone please make this?
It's called like Red Men or something. But yeah, we wanted to talk. Like, we just wanted to talk about Mad Men.
We've got our top men on it. Well, top. What about it? Carrot Top
Men. Carrot Top Men.
Sorry, anyways.
But yeah, like Neil and I, we're huge fans of the show. It's kind of devastating to lose two of my favorite shows in the span of like a year, because you had Boardwalk Empire and you had this show. And it was just like when Boardwalk Empire ended, I was like, oh shit, Mad Men comes back in like 6 months. This is gonna suck. And it kind of did suck. The season was fantastic.
Yes, but, it was.
But each week it just felt worse, because it was just like, oh. Because, quite frankly, Mad Men's been such a constant, you know? Like, it's been such a constant in terms of, like, in TV land that it feels weird saying goodbye to it. It feels like, because there was a couple times, or at least one time, where there was, like, a year hiatus, so... You know, part of my brain's almost like, oh, it's fine. It's just going to be an extended hiatus, whatever. You know, it's going to come back, and it's like, nope, that's it. And I guess what we'll do is that we'll start by talking about the finale and a bit about that, and maybe a little bit of season 7, and then go into a little bit of a retrospective, give our final thoughts on the show and et cetera. I guess I'll just say here, spoilers, like spoiler warning. This is going to go up within the week of the finale anyway. So, yeah. But yeah, Neil, do you want to lead us into a discussion on the Mad Men series finale person to person?
I feel like this finale really made us all sad men now that it's gone.
Okay.
But I would not say that we are glad. I would say that we are glad, men, that it was a satisfying finale. And maybe a little bit of Mad Men that it's never coming back.
I'm a madman because it's not coming back.
I'm mad about Mad Men.
Mad Men. Did you ever see the Sesame Street skit with Mad Men?
Yes, I did.
That was all about glad men and sad men and, yeah.
Yeah, that's... I'm going to be honest. I guess we've all been taking from Sesame Street whenever we do puns about that.
Yeah.
I never thought I'd say that I'm stealing from Sesame Street. And stealing. Now I feel like the world's worst person. Because
mm-hmm.
I'm taking from kids. So it's literally taking candy from babies.
Yeah. But I guess I should just do a quick little overview of the show for those who don't know. And I hope you do know if you're listening to this and you haven't turned it off because of the spoiler warning. But Mad Men basically follows a bunch of it follows a fictional advertising agency on Madison Avenue in New York City during the 1960s. It follows a lot of the staff, the founders, presidents, copyright people, all that kind of stuff. Underlings too, and you do get to see them get promoted, move up, leave, all that kind of stuff. And the linchpin of the show is one, Don Draper, and played by John Hamm. And
Draper, I barely even know her.
Oh, so we have brought our A game today, Neil.
I am in a dark place right now.
Hello, darkness, my old friend.
Oh, hi, darkness, my old friend.
Oh, hi, darkness. I'd do anything for my darkness.
I'd do anything for my Garfunkel.
Oh, hi, Simon.
I'm sorry. I'm just going to be that guy who just keeps chirping in, and I feel like the worst.
But do you have anything you want to add that I may have left out in terms of overview of the show?
No, you've pretty much got the entire thing. That's basically right. Like the gist of the show in its entirety. Like that's like the most basic thing you could go. I mean, like one of the things that's cool is that it follows. I mean, like obviously they're going to do this. You know, they follow like you know the ebb and flow of like culture, society, like you know social change of that time. But I don't think I've ever come across a show on television that has handled it quite like Mad Men, nor would I say as well as Mad Men.
Yeah.
Because Mad Men – okay. Going on to a little bit of a retrospective here, just like calling back to one scene in the series, I'm going to compare it to another show. I don't remember what the hell it was called, but it was about – it was like – it was supposed to be like – a dramatization of the 60s that was about like American Bandstand or something, or like what was it had like Britney Snow in it. I don't remember the name of it, and it's probably because it sucked and it should not be remembered. But I remember seeing the pilot for it, and comparing this to Mad Men shows just how completely different they were and how completely ahead of the game Mad Men was. If you had a show that ever took place in the 60s, even if it took place in like the early 60s, you had to cover the assassination of John F. Kennedy because that was a staple of all that. You always had to do the whole loss of innocence in America in the 60s sort of thing. And so when news of JFK getting assassinated happens in that Britney Snow series, of course, everyone's crying and holding on to each other, and it's slow motion while they play Amazing Grace. I'm not shitting you.
Yes.
I'm seriously not shitting you. That's how the show handles that moment in history in possibly the most histrionic, treacly, like, film student way.
Like, punch you in the face, what's going on kind of thing.
It's as subtle and nuanced as a bacon wrapped brick to the face.
Yeah,
that's what it is. And to be honest, a lot of stuff that covers that same event, that same time period, or even just like an event similar to the JFK assassination, they always treated it, you know, with Amazing Grace, slow motion, hugging and crying. It's always Amazing Grace, probably because it's public domain. Yeah, and you don't have
Amazing
to pay for it.
Amazing Grace. It's in the public domain. That's public. Why we used it twice.
That's right. Thank you, Mr. Science Theater 3000.
What you were saying.
But then you have the way that the JFK assassination is handled in Mad Men, which there is no hugging or slow motion or Amazing Grace. I mean, you have some crying from some people, but you have the entire gamut of political ideals and how people thought of JFK. You have some people who were like, he deserved it. You know, he had it coming towards him with all the shit he was trying to bring up. Then you have people who were like outraged that this could happen. Then you have people who are really sad about this. And not once is there like sad music or anything. It's literally like everyone at that point in time in their day sitting down to watch the news. Yeah. And that's what set Mad Men apart for me, was seeing how it treated the past with, it didn't whitewash over the past. It was like, there was a lot of ugly shit that happened back in the 60s.
Well, yeah, it's like, basically,
and it never treated it with kid gloves.
Yeah. Well, like basically what it was is that it wasn't looking at these past through like, you know, the perspective of someone looking back on it. Yeah. You know, that's what Mad Men did, was that the writers basically set their minds while they were writing at the time, you know, how would people react to it at the time? Of course, now we see it as this great tragedy, you know, because we have had 50 plus years to look at it. So we're adding like unnecessary and kind of, I guess you'd call it biased, maybe. I don't know.
Well, it's looking at the past with modern values.
Exactly.
Which can be good sometimes if you want to learn from it. But especially in art, it's kind of, I don't want to say the word problematic because I don't mean it like that. But it raises some issues because, and I see this a lot nowadays where people like, like they apply, like they judge people from the past, especially like back in the 1800s, by modern, I would say rather like liberal values mm-hmm. of like what people should be like. And I hate to break this to you, but if you look at, if you judge every person from the past, you know, like past, like, you know, 1980 by our standards, guess what? Everyone's awful.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like racism was very prevalent.
Well, racism was very prevalent. Besides probably the Civil War in like the 1860s and before, you know,
you're always going to have that.
Like, but like with the 60s is one of the most, is arguably the most, at least of the modern period of this country, is the most racially driven, like, decade, I guess you'd racially driven, but you know what I mean? Like that's where a lot of like, you know, the rate where the racial issues really came up. And then you had, you know, Martin Luther King, the, you know, Selma, all that kind of stuff. So
yeah, you had the big like social change being pushed.
Both racially, you had, you know, feminism was kind of taking root. Modern day feminism, anyway.
Well, you'd say second wave.
Second wave
feminism.
Yes. I actually have a quote here from MSNBC that basically helps to, which helps with what we're trying to say, which is. The series mostly remains disconnected from the outside world, so the politics and cultural trends of the time are illustrated through people in their lives, not broad, sweeping arguments.
Yes.
Yeah.
And even though usually MSNBC is as bad as Fox is in terms of, like, actual journalistic integrity, they nailed it right there. Like, that's sort of one of the things I always loved about the series.
Yeah.
Is that it doesn't try to play by modern standards. It basically tells you this is the past, take it or leave it.
Basically, yeah. And what I love is that they focus on, like, the bad shit that happened in the 60s, because we kind of idealize the 60s and the 50s, too. So a lot of this stuff...
there's also a lot of great stuff about the 60s, too, but it also shows... It's very just matter of fact.
Yeah, because it's like how much people smoked, how much people drank, the sexism.
I mean like, the scene in the first season where Don, Betty, and the kids go out and have a picnic... And then right at the end, they just leave everything and they just like throw everything on the ground. Like that's it. That was the 60s. That's everything you need to know right there. That's the 60s. Well, like Mad Men back in its first season was very on the nose about the 60s. And then in the second season, they calmed down considerably and started to approach it. They gathered the approach that made it famous for what it is now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, glacial pacing, you know, not spelling everything out, you know, a lot more nuanced, subtle television.
A lot of symbolism
rather than just being really on the nose about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that being a really jarring change when I was watching the series. Cause I owned the first season. I got it for Christmas. I got it for my birthday, my freshman year of college, because that was when the second season was on, and I was like, I'm hearing some pretty good stuff about the show. I really want it. So my parents got it for me, and I watched it, and I was like, this is amazing. And then the second season wasn't out on DVD yet, so I had to go online and watch it illegally. And I remember being, like, really confused by what I was watching, because it's such a hard left from what the first season is. I mean, like, I can't complain. I would say it's probably one of the weakest of the series besides season one.
Yeah,
because that's where
I think I would argue the show really picked up. The show really, I think, between seasons three and like five were like the best, at least the most consistent.
I would say that four is probably the best of the series.
Yeah, and then
even though, like, you know, it was never bad. Like, you know, even this season.
Yeah.
Like, I would say the last few episodes, I would say, like, the last three episodes of this season of Mad Men, like, the last three episodes, period, could have vied for, like, you know, best of the series.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
And then it would always come up against The Suitcase, and it would lose.
Yeah, because that was season four, right?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, season four was a really, really great season.
Season four is basically like it's the same thing with The Simpsons, where season four of The Simpsons is when it became what, like, I would say season four of The Simpsons is the best season.
Yeah.
Like, it really came into its own thing. Like, it finally nailed exactly what it was doing. So season four, I would say, is probably the apex of the series, even though the rest of it's fantastic.
Yeah, like, well, and when we say, like, what we're saying is basically, like, it has the same ups and downs as most great shows. Like, Breaking Bad had its fair share of ups and downs. Game of Thrones, which is still running, has had its fair shares of ups and downs.
Like Danny's, like Daenerys' storyline in season two.
Yeah, Daenerys has been, like, for as much praise as she gets as a character, and Emilia Clarke is great as her.
Yeah.
What they give her to do, like season one, like, half of it was great. Season two sucked. Season three was pretty good.
Yeah.
was okay. And then last season was pretty good. And then this season's, like, you're not sure yet because we're still in it, but...
Yeah, it's still, like, yeah, we just haven't finished the season yet, so I can't tell what's going on.
Yeah, but season two was, like, that was
where
definitely the weed.
Where are my dragons? OMG, where are my dragons? I have to say, though, the episode where my dragons starts is also the episode where Joffrey gets shit flown at his face. And that's a highlight of the series right there. So that episode brought about one of the best things to happen, but also one of the worst things to happen.
Yeah. But
God bless you, Game of Thrones. I still love you.
But with Mad Men, like, it deals with a lot of heavy themes, like, especially the theme of identity, you know?
Yes.
Because a main aspect of the story is Don Draper's character and how he is not actually Don Draper. He is a man named Dick Whitman who... he's a Vietnam veteran, and while in Vietnam, his commanding officer, who was named Don Draper, is killed in an accident. And Dick...
Big fire explosion.
Yeah, big fire explosion. Great big bushy beard. And Dick basically takes his identity and basically runs away from his past and becomes Don Draper. And that's his driving force. And that could kind of lead into a little bit of talking about the finale, because... The whole series is about Don Draper basically trying to make do with, or like trying to live up to the name that he, the identity that he has taken. Like, and that really comes to the head in the finale, Person to Person. You even have a scene where, and I remember talking to Casey about this, is that, this is an episode of Phone Calls, Person to Person, which it makes sense because it's called Person to Person and that's in relation to phone calls. And
I thought it was like a relation to that show Sister to Sister.
sister.
Oh wait, no, that was Jungle. Oh my god, no, I botched that. That's actually I was thinking of the movie Jungle to Jungle.
Jungle to Jungle. Yeah, it's Person to Person, Jungle to Jungle.
Oh my god. Okay, just scratch that.
Totally an understandable mistake to confuse a fucking Tim Allen movie with Tia Tamara Mowry's sitcom about being twins.
They're practically the same. They really are. Jungle of high school, am I right?
Jungle to sister, yeah. Oh. Jungle to person, back to jungle. Person to sister to jungle to sister to person.
I totally understood that.
But yeah, this episode where basically what happens is Don Sterling Cooper and Partners, which, you know, Sterling Cooper, which is the ad agency, goes through several forms in the series, and by the end of the 60s it becomes Sterling Cooper and Partners, where it is Roger Burt Cooper, who by this point is dead, Don, Pete Campbell, Joan, and maybe Ted? Ted might be
Ted Shaw. Yeah,
Ted Shaw, yeah. And they are basically being bought by what's the name of the actual
McCann
agency?
Erickson.
What's it, McCann Erickson? Right, yeah. McCann Erickson, which is a real place. It's a real ad agency. Yes. And, you know, everyone, like, there's kind of a rocky transition, you know, a lot of the lower tier employees are kind of like, oh, what to do, but a lot of the higher-ups, you know, our main characters see it as opportunity, and Don's a little conflicted, but, you know, he gets what he wants, which is Coke. He wants the Coke account. He wants to work for Coke and do ads for Coke. And
not the nose candy.
Not the nose candy, which Joan has some.
Yeah, that was great. That was the best description of drugs ever.
It's like, I just got like some really good news.
Some really good news.
There was a part of me that was worried that she was going to get like addicted to cocaine by the end of it. I'm like, no.
This show's better than that.
This show's better than that. Like, I feel really silly like having doubts in the show now, because there was like a lot of worries, because there was a lot of people like saying like Don was going to kill himself, you know. But and because they look at the opening and Don, it's like basically a figure falling out of a building, flying by a bunch of ads and stuff.
Did you ever find that like that one spec script that was supposed to be like the final scene of Mad Men?
No, it didn't.
They tied in like Don Draper throwing himself out of a building. No. It's really fucking stupid. It really is.
Well, because it's like it, and like I was worried. There was a big part of me that was like, I hope they don't do this. Like, I want to have faith in Matthew Weiner because he's a really good writer. He's a great showrunner. This is a really awesome show that has done very little stupid things, very few stupid things, and I don't want it to be that. And thankfully, they didn't do that. What's great about it is, and we'll get to the actual ending in a little bit, but you could actually take the opening of the show. Like, it actually does come to fruition in the finale, but it's all metaphorical. You know, about basically Don falling to his lowest and then finally finding a new perspective on something.
Icarus symbolism.
Oh, see? And this show's really underrated in terms of symbolism. I love it. There's so much symbolic stuff that you could just kind of like look at, like look how a scene's shot and how it's lit and all that kind of stuff. And you just take, you know, so many different little interpretations of it. Like, one thing I loved was an episode a few earlier in the final season where, do you remember the one that starts with Don making milkshakes for his sons, Bobby and Eugene?
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's making them, and, you know, Betty's there, and he's just kind of visiting his sons because at this point he's divorced from his wife, Betty, and he's already remarried to and divorced again. He makes them milkshakes, he's talking to him, and then Betty's current husband, Henry, walks in. And so that's basically, Don sees that as a cue to, you know, get ready to go. And as he's leaving, he stops in the doorway and looks back, and he sees, you know, Henry is basically in the same place he was making milkshakes. And the way it's lit, you could see that Henry's hair is darker, because Henry has, like, gray hair, and Don has dark hair. And it looks like Don is still in that scene. So it's almost him looking back and like seeing a what if scenario of like, this could be me, you know, whatever, if I could actually, you know, find happiness and actually accept happiness and that kind of stuff. And that's what Don really deals with through the whole show, is like it's such an interesting, because I think Don Draper is one of the most underrated characters in TV in terms of just how much praise he gets. You know, like, if you ask me, and I said this on, I remember I tweeted this out, unpopular opinion time, I actually prefer Don Draper to Walter White. Because I think,
I was like, no, I can see that. I like them both for different reasons.
I like them both for different reasons, too, but I think this is coming from the fact that, like, Walter White gets so much praise as a character, and I think so much of his, so much of what makes Walter White is Bryan Cranston's performance, which is fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Well, but I feel like a lot of people who, like, overpraise Walter White's character as sort of, like, this badass are the same people who completely miss the point of Brian De Palma's Scarface.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just going to say that.
Like, a cautionary tale and not, like, a celebratory story.
Yeah, exactly.
But, yeah, and I think Don is, you know, I personally think he's got a lot more layers to him than, say, Walter White, you know. And
with Don Draper, a lot of it is left up to interpretation.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I really like about the show, as well as Don Draper himself. Just that Don Draper means a lot of things to a lot of different people. You know, like, his motivations can differ from person to person if you ask them. Uh-huh. Like, we were talking about the AV Club reviews, you know, the ones by John Teddy. And John Teddy, I think, just automatically assumes the worst in Don Draper. Like, there are a lot of reviews where he's like, oh, well, Don does this because he's a horrible fucking person. It's like, no.
Well, and that's what.
And then you have people. And then you have people in the comments section who are like, "Actually, Don did the right thing right there. You know, like, actually, there was really nothing he could have done." So I was like, "Fuck you, Teddy."
Well, but that's what's so great about him is that he's a character that you could see him two different ways, and that even carries over into the actual like ending of the show. But
yeah.
what I was getting to was that you have this man who's basically looking for happiness, you know, trying to add something to the name Don Draper, but he feels like he's just failed so far. You know, he's not a good father. He's not a good, you know, friend, et cetera, et cetera. And yet he's constantly trying to sell happiness to people. You know, he's trying to sell products to people that with the intention that this basically the mission statement of every advertisement ever is like, this will make you happier if you have this, you know? And that's one of the, that's like the great backbone of the show is that here's a guy who basically sells happiness and he's unhappy. You know,
always the bridesmaid, never the bride.
I can never catch the bouquet.
I have little T-Rex arms.
White men can't jump. But
not in those suits, they can't.
Yeah, but I think that's what's so great about Don Draper, and I think John Hamm is completely underrated as Don. Like the fact that he has zero Emmys wins to his name, even though he's been nominated every season. You know,
but Jeff Daniels has an Emmy.
But Jeff Daniels has a fucking Emmy. Think about that, people. The fucking newsroom has more. Forget. Has more. Yeah, never forget. The newsroom.
Never forget, never forgive.
Has more acting Emmys than Mad Men. Think about that. A show that fucking ended last year that only lasted fucking three seasons and most people hate.
As well they should.
Because
doesn't that really make you mad, man?
That makes me mad, man. And, like, the only reason that Jeff Daniels won that is for his fucking speech in the first episode. Like,
which...
Straight
up. Yeah.
Which is a good speech.
It's a good speech, but there are some things that I have qualms with it.
But he's also, like it just kind of makes him come off like a fucking asshole.
Well, it's Aaron Sorkin, you know, old man yells at cloud.
Yeah.
That's the best way to describe the speech. So, it's just Aaron Sorkin getting mad about things.
I wish the show could just win all the awards. And I know, like, and I'm not saying necessarily that Breaking Bad doesn't deserve the Emmys it wins, even though I would argue that the fact that it basically won two, like, Bryan Cranston won, like, did he win two Emmys for season five?
Oh, yeah, I guess he did.
For season five, because they split it in two, which is such a crock. You know, the fact that, you know, he basically won two awards. I think Aaron Paul also won two awards for the same season.
Yeah.
Which is kind of garbage, but...
But they were so good!
But they were good, but it's, like, not for the same fucking season. Come on, man. That's just such a cheap thing that they're doing with TV now. Let's split the season.
Well, they do that with movies, too.
Well, movies... I feel like with movies... There's still more of like a we want to tell more story. Like you can tell with the next Avengers movie being two movies that
The new Divergent movie is be split two.
The reason why Divergent's like that is because fucking Hunger Games did that.
Yeah, you know, Hunger Games actually deserved it.
Well, it's like Harry Potter. It's like you know you do the seventh book in two parts, but it's like with TV. With TV, you have obviously more time to tell a story than a movie, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, splitting it in two just feels more like we want to keep this going for as long. Like, especially with AMC, where now they're without... Because now AMC is without its two best shows, Breaking Bad and Mad Men.
Yeah, without the two shows that, like, basically put them on the map.
Yeah.
Now they have Walking Dead.
Which they shouldn't be too mad about having.
Halt and Catch Fire.
Halt and Catch Fire. And then that, and then apparently the making of The Mob, which is a really fucking huge ripoff of Breaking Boardwalk Empire.
Yeah. I can only give AMC so much because they did bring Better Call Saul
existence. They do have Better Call Saul now. So
you've watched Better Call Saul, right?
I haven't yet.
Oh, man.
Oh, Oh, why, shit, dude.
Why do you say these things that hurt me?
I don't know.
I would argue that Better Call Saul might actually be better than, like, the first two seasons of Breaking Bad.
I can get behind that.
I know it's a pretty big claim, but, like, Better Call Saul just hits the ground running and knows exactly where it's going.
I think Breaking Bad really became Breaking Bad in season three.
Yeah, season three and season four
are, like, those are the two best seasons of that show. And then five is, like, it's good, but it's somewhere in between, you know, one and two and three and four, you know?
I don't know. Season five did give us Ozymandias, so I can't say.
Yeah, but it's just, like, kind of getting to Ozymandias is where I kind of have a little bit of a... Just because I feel like some of the stuff was kind of dragged out. And actually, segue time. Something that I've noticed with shows recently, as I think, in terms of recent finales, you know, Mad Men, Boardwalk Empire, Breaking Bad, you know, shows that I've actually watched, it's interesting to kind of compare how they handle their last season, because I think Boardwalk Empire still has probably the best pacing of a final season for me. And granted, this is a little unfair just because of the subject matter of that show, because it's like people die all the time and it's about gangsters. But
it's true. They really do.
But there's such a sense of dread in that season.
Oh, yeah.
And I love it. It's like fucking palpable. You know, yeah. And like, I think that's, it has something that season five of, at least season five, part two, whatever you want to say, of Boardwalk Empire, or not, of Breaking Bad, I'm getting my shows mixed up, of Breaking Bad.
They both start with B's, so
it's okay. Yeah. With Breaking Bad, it's like, it felt like it took a little bit too much time for my taste, like, you know.
That's one of those where I mean, like, I love the shit out of Breaking Bad, and I love season five. But that's one of those where I would argue that maybe having, like, two fewer episodes would have done it better.
Yes, I would totally agree with that.
But even then, like, not like I mind the extra episodes.
Yeah, not that it's, like, it ruins anything, but it's, like...
More Breaking Bad.
Yeah, I just almost wish you took, like, one episode and, like, split it in two and put it on two other episodes.
Yeah.
You know, or something like that. Because I feel like, basically, between when Hank finds out Walt's secret and when... shit actually comes up with him in, like, Ozymandias. Yeah. I feel like it's a little, like, there's, like, it kind of drags its feet a little bit.
Like, I can see that.
Like, there might be, like, one episode where that I find a little unnecessary. Yeah. And, like, Mad Men is interesting, too, this final season, because, of course, it doesn't have the same kind of storyline going on. You don't have the stakes of Breaking Bad and Boardwalk Empire where people fucking die. And it'd be really interesting to watch both part one and part two of season seven together, just to kind of get a feel for it. Since season seven, part one feels like a completely different season than season seven, part two.
Yeah.
Cause it's like, Megan shows up in like one episode of this season, right?
Yeah. She only shows up for one.
Yeah. And it's like, it's interesting how like, There's definitely stuff that they kind of leave hanging in this season. Like, Megan just kind of, like, isn't the last we see her is, like, having lunch with Harry?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's, like, she leaves, and then that's kind of it. And it's, like, oh. Like, I almost thought that there would be, like, some kind of follow-up to that when Dawn eventually makes it to California in the finale, but I guess not. And, you know, you have... But, like, by and large, a lot of people, like, most characters get their own little send-off. Like, Pete gets one.
Yeah.
Peggy gets one. Joan gets one. Roger gets one, et cetera, you know.
The argument could be made that, you know, Megan gets about as much of a send-off as, like, Sal.
Yeah. Oh, God.
I remember Sal.
I miss Sal. Like, Sal was a character that I loved in the first few seasons. What season did he leave? Three? Sal. What's that?
I said, goddamn, I loved Sal.
Sal was awesome.
I think Sal was season three where he departed.
Which he would have been such an interesting character to follow because, you know, he's gay. And so you can kind of address the homophobia of the time in a bit. And they do. They touch on that.
They do. They really do.
But you almost wish that, I almost wish that he kept, like, he was a figure that would come back eventually. Kind of like what Paul did, remember? Where he was, like, part of the Hare Krishna.
Yeah. I hear rumors about the reason that Saul... Or, sorry, Sal.
Better Call Sal.
Better Call Sal. Dude, I'd watch the shit out of that.
I would totally watch the shit out of Better Call Sal.
It'd just be like just the sassiest thing
ever. And it would be a buddy cop show with Salvatore and Sally Draper.
I hate you when you give me things I can't have. Because I was thinking about, I would love to see a spinoff with Sally Draper, but then pairing her with Sal.
That'd be awesome. Quick shout out to Kieran and Shipka. She's fucking awesome.
Yes, she is.
Like, she plays Sally Draper, Don's oldest child. Just, it's so interesting to watch her, because you basically watch her age.
You really
show.
Do.
Like, you know, it's eight or nine years the show ran?
Yeah.
No, it was 8 years. It was 2007.
It was 8 years.
Yeah, and you basically watch a child age into a young woman, and it's awesome. And her character, Sally Draper, is such grows into a really interesting character because she's a kid.
Would you say it was like girlhood?
Shut the fuck up, Neil. But you know what I mean.
No, exactly. And then you have little Bobby Draper, who was a role so big that no one child actor could be contained.
like Gene. Like Gene's like a pair of twins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bobby Draper just doesn't age. He just doesn't age ever.
Yeah, he just kind of like stopped aging. Like he feels like he's the same age like 2 years ago.
Yeah.
In like really season is. Six.
He really is. Yeah. I was watching an episode from season two a couple days ago, and yeah, Bobby Draper looks pretty much the same.
I am immortal.
Anyways, I was going to say, I heard some rumors. I heard some here talk, if you will. I just created that term, and it should die because no one should ever use it because it's terrible. That the reason that Sal had an early departure, if you will, was because Brian Blatt, the actor who played Sal, was very uncomplimentary towards the kid who plays Glenn, who is Matthew Weiner's son.
Oh, really?
Yes, apparently he was very vocal about his distaste for his acting, and that was the reason he was booted. But then again, that is just vicious, nasty, you know, rumors to go. So I don't know if they're right or not. They're just kind of delicious and entertaining.
Really?
And possibly true.
Then I'm just imagining that last scene with Glenn in season 7, like where he's saying goodbye because he's about to go to Vietnam.
Tries to Mac on Betty.
Yeah, and then you see, like, Brian Bat in, like, a window. He's like, you suck!
Like, can you just imagine, like, Matthew Weiner, like, directing his son to do that? There's just, I don't know.
This character that's basically kind of an inspiration, like, she's basically inspired by your grandma. I want you to fucking hit on her. Yes. I don't know.
Mr. Snyder.
Mr. Snyder.
Just go in for a little, you know, a little boob action right there.
Yeah,
just
cross
the arm. That's okay.
Don't worry. January is totally into it. And she's like, what?
She's like, I am cold like the month of January. Wah, wah, wah.
Buena, buena.
She doesn't say much. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, this, I don't know, I just thought
poor
about
January
that.
Jones. January Jones, in my opinion, always got a really bad rap.
I think she got a bad rap because we watched her in everything else she was in that wasn't Mad Men, and it was like, what the fuck is this?
Well, it's like, everyone was like, oh, she's one of the weakest parts of Mad Men, and it's like, granted, that's like basically, that's really tough competition, you know, because like everyone else is firing on cylinders, and she's on like 80%, maybe 75%. Yeah. But I think in this last season, she really gets going.
She really did. Well, you've noticed like an improvement in her acting as time goes on. Yeah. Like, she really owns Betty Draper in this past season. Like, she does such an amazing job with it. And apparently you can see it in other projects too. Like, I haven't seen The Last Man on Earth on Fox, but she's in that.
Oh my God.
Yeah. She's in it. And people were like, she's actually really good in there. Like, she's actually, like, you can tell she's having, like, a great time. Like,
yeah.
Wow, maybe she finally got there, you know? Because then you look at her in X-Men First Class, and it's like, did you sleep with the director or something? Like, how are you in this?
It's almost like you did.
That's weird.
That's like our respective laugh.
Yeah, those rumors were unfounded, and I don't know why she went about saying the things that she did the way that she did. So mm-hmm. I really don't know what to say of it. It's just like, yeah. Well, that was dumb.
Yeah. But anyway, by the end of the show, I guess
anyways, back to Sad Men.
Back to Sad Men. We're Sad Men because Mad Men's over. back to the finale. So at this point, you know, I brought up Don basically at McCann and Erickson. He basically gets the white whale of accounts that he wants, which is Coke. But he goes to a meeting and suddenly he just kind of, how would you describe it? Like, he just kind of realizes how bullshit it is. Like, he's just,
I don't want to say he has like a breakdown, cause it's not like an over, it's like, it's not like, you know,
it's not the Hershey pitch.
It's not the Hershey pitch, but it's almost like a silent meltdown where he just suddenly the rose tinted glasses are off. And yeah, I guess you could say that it's basically him realizing that everything's bullshit.
Yeah.
Well, it's like hearing that pitch, which is support. So, which is kind of Draper esque. Except all the things, you ever notice in Don Draper's pitches, they're all very specific. They're, like, all of the characters that he pitches in those feel very well realized. They feel like, yeah. You know, like fully realized people. And then in that dude's pitch for Light Beer, or whatever it was supposed to be.
Well, it's supposed to be probably Miller Lite.
Yeah, for Miller Lite. The guy starts off sort of like Don would, and then just kind of butchers it. Like it's not a fully realized character by any means. And then of course, seeing how everyone's like ready to write things down, but it's like, what the fuck do you write down at that pitch? What yeah. are you going to write down? There's nothing to do. And then hearing Ted Chaw spit out the same thing that the head of McCann had told Don, you know, where he was just so happy to be there to give it that special touch, you know, yeah. hearing that used on everyone else and realizing he's not special.
Mm-hmm.
Don Draper is, I don't want to say he's just another cog in the machine, but that's essentially what it is.
He is a cog, just another brick in the wall, man.
I remember when I was talking to Jason Fisher about like what if he would ever do, if he was ever to get on like Pixar or something, like if he was ever to land an animation job at Pixar or DreamWorks or, you know, Leica or something like that. He doesn't do stop motion, but you get the idea. And he turned that down. And I understood completely why he would, where he was saying, like, you know, why be a part of a machine that basically you help run when yeah. you can be a part of something smaller and you can make it successful because of you, because of what you did, rather than just like you being a collective effort, you know, you helped build it to what it is, rather than just keeping it afloat. You right. raised it high.
Right.
And I agree with him wholeheartedly. I'm having that sort of crisis right now.
Well, it's like, and that's why that sounds so like Jason, because Bill Plimpton, a guy who does most of his films by himself.
Yeah.
Is pretty much his favorite animator and creator.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And that applies to Don. Like, you know, Don was the rock star of the advertising world.
Mm-hmm.
He really was. And then, of course, as he gets older, he becomes more, I don't want to say out of touch, but he becomes more obsolete. And then yeah. sitting in McCann's offices during that meeting is just him realizing he's not special anymore.
Yeah. Well, that's like, that's another big part of the arc of the show, is that you basically yeah. have all these guys in 1960 that are just hotshots and very much just carryovers from the 50s. And then they basically just keep hitting obstacle after obstacle, basically reminding them that the world is changing. The old world is gone,
yeah.
You know, and you have to adapt.
Yeah,
and you have people like, I mean, Roger kind of adapted in a way. Like, oh, it's interesting. Roger,
absolutely. Well, that's the thing that I find really interesting about this, especially this last season, the past two seasons, is watching as the fashion around them changes, especially when they get to the 70s. Look at Roger. Roger adapts the 70s, like adopts the 70s almost immediately, like with his porn stash and, you know, like. I don't remember if he had a bolo tie at one point, but you know, like he definitely looked like a man of the 70s. Whereas Don, he looks like the same.
He never changes. Yeah.
Like, and that really does contribute to his, you know, feeling like a man out of time.
Well, and it's like, also
out of his time.
It's about like he doesn't have an identity really. Like it's kind of like he has his these battles with identity. So it's not like he's going to go and just change how he looks, you know, because he's still trying to figure out his current identity. So he can't even change it to fit the times because he's so conflicted with who he is right now. Like who he was in 1960 is still, you know, on his mind and still raggling around in his head. Yeah. And it's, again, that's another piece of symbolism that I love about the show. It's just, they have all these visual metaphors too. And just like, you know, Don, again, he is the only person that doesn't change. You know, he doesn't change. Like, the only thing is that John Hamm gets older. Really? Like,
that's the thing John Hamm loves about those women. He gets older. Don't stay the same age.
Damn it.
I'm sorry.
He gets older and they also get older, but he still wants to bang them.
But he still wears the same clothes.
Ew.
Yeah, I know.
But anyway, back to the finale as it is. And so Don basically just walks out of this pitch and just drives.
That's a Tick of the Clock by the Chromatics, which is famous from Drive. If anyone has, that's an inside joke between Taylor and I. Spanning back to when he and I used to live together back at the Savannah College of Art and Design, where we used to break into song of that particular piece of music whenever we saw a trailer for Drive. It was the best thing ever, and we had a great time. Harkening back to a time of about maybe 3 or 4 years ago. Yeah, it was great.
Nice little asterisk there.
No problem. I just turned into David Foster Wallace for a second.
but for real. And then, you know, early in this half of the season, he meets, is it Diana? Is her name? Like the waitress that he hooks up with. Yeah. And she's supposedly from Wisconsin, I believe.
I believe it was Wisconsin.
Something like that. Somewhere out west. And
some dumb state. I don't know.
Something dumb, like Iowa.
Residents of Iowa or Wisconsin who are listening to this.
The opinion of Neil and Taylor do not reflect the opinions of Geeks at Large at large.
but I meant what I said.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
No, not actually. I've never been there, so yeah. I'm sure it's
lovely. Man, they have cheese, and they have the Packers, and they have cows, and they have half in the bag. Red Letter Media.
It's true. I do love Red Letter Media.
But not cheese.
But not cheese. I'm getting better at cheese.
You better get better at cheese.
I can eat enchiladas. I can eat Mexican food with cheese on it now, and I like it just fine. Enchiladas are like my favorite shit ever.
Dude, enchiladas are fucking awesome. The rest of this episode is just going to be talking about fucking enchiladas.
It's going to be like watching Steven Universe and always talking about hot dogs.
Exactly.
I promise I don't have like an oral fixation. I just really fucking love hot dogs.
You love shoving those wieners in your mouth.
Boiling the wiener.
This joke has been brought to you by 8-year-old Taylor. So basically, Penis. Don just like he doesn't he go and see
like he goes over to Diana Bauer's ex-husband's place.
And then that's awkward. That's awkward because he basically poses as another character, like I'm not a character, but like he fakes an identity to be like a salesman who's giving a prize to.
And then, like, that one fault, like, you know, the husband, the ex-husband, like, sees right through that, and then he takes on another fake one where he's, like a repossessor.
Yeah.
like a collector or something.
Yeah.
That was insane. That was a crazy scene.
Yeah, exactly. And then he just keeps going west. He goes to Oklahoma, and that's in the penultimate episode, which is a really great episode where he actually... he stays at this motel and kind of befriends the owners and cause his car is basically went kaput and has to be fixed. And the owner of the motel is also a veteran, I believe from World War II.
Yes.
And so he invites Don to this, you know, basically to the Legion, you know, where all the veterans are. And then we get to see Roy from fucking The Office.
Yeah.
That confused the hell out of me.
That was awesome. I'm like, oh, he's not dead or something.
Yeah. You're always happy to see actors that aren't dead.
Yes.
We need more diversity. We need more dead actors.
And so Don starts to bond with all these veterans and they start to tell stories. And then Don, for the first time in the entire show, he opens up and talks about the incident where his commanding officer dies and he takes his identity. He doesn't mention that part, but he mentions that he is responsible for his commanding officer dying, you know, which is the biggest weight on his conscience and his existence, yeah. You know.
And these people accept him.
Yeah, they're just like, that's just – I love
– Name of the game.
Well, no, I love how it's the name of the game. Like, I love how he focuses on name because it's, you know, Don took the guy's name.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of clever little weird tics like that I love about the show, too.
You get it, Icarus symbolism.
But then, of course, Don gets accused of stealing the donations from the party, which actually were stolen by this, like, hustler kid. Not to be confused with Hustler Kid from Recess.
Not to be confused with Hustler Magazine. Who buys Hustler Magazine, Hustler Kid.
Whoa. And of course you have this parallel between Don and this kid where this kid is trying to, you know, is basically a con artist, and you could argue that Don is a con artist too. And Don's basically telling him basically like an autobiographical story about how, like, you don't want to do this. You know, you're gonna regret this, et cetera, et cetera.
Slipping Jimmy.
And Don is basically kicked out of the motel, and the kid comes with him, and then they stop at a bus stop, which initially Don was supposed to drop the kid off at, but he gives the kid his car. Like, another thing that Don has just kind of let go of his old life. Kicked out of Compton.
I was waiting on that one. Yeah, and then the episode ends with Buddy Holly's song, Every Day. It's such a good song. Sorry. You were talking about, like, the themes of identity.
Yeah.
I would say that, like, you know, if there's one theme I have to bring up about the series that I always thought was really interesting was about how people are going, like, it's basically cycles.
Yes.
Like, people are always going to make the same decisions, and it's always going to guide their lives. Like, you know, with Dawn and the type of women that he chooses, they're all brunettes.
Except for Betty.
Well, there was also in season 4, back when he had to choose between the higher up woman, who I think was like a psychiatrist,
mm-hmm.
and then Megan. He chose the brunette, even though that other woman was like way better for him.
Well, yeah, and that's the kind of an interesting thing about his relationship with Betty, is that Betty is like she's special to him. Like, yeah. You know, all the other women are just flings, even Megan, but like, Betty, he still talks to Betty, and like, Betty's just kind of, I don't know.
Basically, she's kind of, you can almost say she's kind of like the mother figure that he never had.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah. And that sort of, okay. What color, what was the hair color of the woman that sexually assaulted him in the brothel? Because I feel like that plays a big role into it. Was she brunette as well?
That, or maybe she was blonde.
See, that's the, like, I'm having a trouble remembering, like, which hair color it was, because it was pretty significant.
Listeners, if you remember when we used to say sha-la-la-la-la-la-la-la, please put it down in the comments.
Yes.
It's very important that we know.
And you can call me out for not having done my research and having watched it before going on this podcast.
But it was in season 6, and the flashbacks were kind of, like, iffy. In that season, like,
I liked them,
but it's like that season 6 is an interesting season because it's probably the most, like, just looking at a season on its own, it's probably the most uneven.
Yeah, you know, but it's also the one that started trying to do like more like extended arcs throughout the season.
Yeah,
and I appreciate it doing what it tried to do, and I think that in season 7. It definitely fixed that. Like, it did what it was supposed to be doing.
Yeah, it's definitely an example of, like, it's ambitious, but it stumbles.
Yeah.
Which is better than, you know, trying to be more of the same and excelling at it.
Sucking.
No. But, but yeah, like, Betty has always been, like, there's even symbolism in that, is that Betty is blonde, and then, you know, all the other flings before and after and during his marriage to Betty. Betty has been the constant.
Yeah.
You know, who's the ex-wife that shows up in the finale? It's Betty, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
She was there in the beginning. She was there in the end. So there's symbolism in that. There's significance in that. And
yeah. But that's one of the major themes that I found really fascinating about the series was just like the idea of cycles and how, like, you know, you notice that everyone seems to be making the same mistakes, the same decisions, and like how, you know, you think they're going to change and then they just, like, the past behavior really informs the future.
Right.
You know, about how, you know, what's that saying? Like, the child is the father of the adult.
Yeah.
The child is the father of the man.
Mm-hmm.
And how, like, you know, what you do as a child is just basically going to inform what you do as an adult.
Right.
And Mad Men definitely works with that. So that's, and then, like, you notice towards the end of the series, you know, a lot of breaking of cycles. Like,
oh, yeah.
Pete, like, especially Pete, Pete Campbell, who has been probably one of the most fascinating characters on the series, even though, like, you know, I loved watching Pete get punched, but I also am really glad to see him finally get his happy ending. Like, yeah. Pete finally breaks through this cycle of, like, you know, chasing after women that he shouldn't be.
Which is something, you know, he learned from his father.
Yeah, because his father was the worst, and his brother was also the second worst.
His brother that looks nothing like him.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, you could say that, like, you know, my brother and I don't look exactly
like
each other.
You guys can still, like, look like you're related. That's true. His dad's, or his brother's basically like Mark Addy, for fuck's sake. It's like...
He really is. But it's like all of a sudden when Don isn't in the picture anymore, I feel like this entire series has been Pete trying to emulate Don. Like he's like, he thinks that Don is what a modern man is supposed to be.
Yeah.
And then when Don isn't there anymore, Pete's finally able to break free of that cycle of trying to emulate Don, trying to be Don.
And then what's funny is that he does kind of emulate Don in the end because, but he just, like, tweaks it a bit to make it more positive, is that he runs away and he wants to start a new life just like Don wanted to, but he does it with his wife and child.
Yeah.
So it's like, hey, it's like he took Don's lead, but he made it his own in a way in the end. Yeah. And then
I'm just so happy to see he and his wife get back together.
Him and Alison Brie.
Yeah.
It was so weird. I remember when, because Alison Brie was on Mad Men before she was on Community.
That's right.
And I remember it threw me for a loop.
She was also in that Adult Swim short, like Hot Sluts or whatever.
What?
Yeah, you've never seen it?
No.
It's hilarious. No. It's also got like the most aggressive case of post-production, like sharpening of an image that I've ever seen. And it looks ugly as hell, but it's also really funny. But, so that's actually how I knew her before Mad Men.
Yeah, I knew her from a really shitty horror movie called Bourne. That was really funny.
Yeah.
That one's awesomely stupid.
Anyways.
But anyway, and then, of course, we have Don, you know, he leaves Oklahoma. He makes it out there. He eventually makes it to California, where he meets up with Stephanie, who is the niece of the actual Donald Draper's wife. So, because that's also another thing that, like, Don was doing at different points in his life, is that he was actually, since he was technically married to, he's Don Draper, so he's married to the wife of Don Draper, who is Anna Draper. So, you know, in between the start of the series and Don's period in Korea, he actually befriends the widow of the man that, you know, Don took his identity from. And they have a really interesting relationship. And if you want to know where the sad Don Draper meme came from, it's from there. And it's part of what makes The Suitcase awesome. Because that happens in The Suitcase, right?
Yeah, that's the episode of The Suitcase.
Where eventually Anna gets cancer, right? And she dies. And then it's one of those, like Mad Men, it's like each season has at least like one scene that just kind of takes you completely by surprise. The lawnmower.
Oh my god. Okay.
And then,
so funny enough, the lawnmower is actually special because the lawnmower was the first episode that I watched like in real time.
Yeah.
When I was at SCAD.
Oh yeah.
And I was living with Will.
Your friend Will.
Bobo
Lobo on YouTube.
On the YouTubes.
On the YouTubes.
That was the first episode that he watched with me. So the lawnmower scene, we had no idea that was coming.
Yeah.
So but that episode holds a special place in my heart. And of course, he was like, I don't think this show's for me.
Well, because like, you have that scene. You've got the fight between Lane and Pete. You've got...
He calls him a grimy pimp.
Yeah. And then you got the fucking... You've got, of course, when Anna's, like, ghost appears in front of Dawn. You've got this season where you have the musical number with Bert Cooper. You've got the Ellis, the was it the acid scene with Roger?
Yeah.
Where he takes a LSD, which was amazing.
It's amazing.
Yeah, and every season has like at least that one part that's just like, and then you have the season where they do Tomorrow Never Knows, which is still probably one, like top three favorite scenes of the whole show.
Yeah.
Which just really drives home the whole like changing times and how Dawn is not game with it because you have this, which was at the time a very experimental record by the Beatles, Tomorrow Never Knows. He listens to it.
And he turns it off.
And he turns it off and walks away. And it's done beautifully over this montage of people and the changing times. And it's so great. And
yeah.
Fucking awesome, and my jaw was on the floor when it happened. You know, so good.
We were watching that together when that happened.
Yeah, and I think both of our jaws were on the floor because it was so awesome.
Yeah, we were like, "What is this happening? This is great.
This is happening."
And then, of course, the next question became, "How did they afford the money?"
And Matthew Weiner like dumped it out himself. It was like, "Here's $500,000 or something like that."
Yeah, it was a lot, and it's absolutely worth it. It is. Absolutely. That's one of those where, like, the money goes towards one little thing, but that one little thing is so absolutely vital and important that, you know, you can't fault it.
And so, anyway, Dawn makes it to California. He reunites with Stephanie, the niece of Anna, and he wants to give her Anna's ring that he got. Just as, like, because it was... And it's just kind of an interesting character moment because it's like Dawn has had this for how many years? Like 15 or something like that? Like forever. Maybe even 20 years. You know, almost 20 years.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of an interesting little, you know, moment of humanity that he kept this. Of course, she, you know, rejects it and eventually, you know, realizing that Dawn is having a huge, like, existential crisis, takes him to this, like, self-improvement hippie commune, and you know Dawn isn't buying it. You have the great scene where you know you basically stop, like you basically all the people in like the session are just walking around the room and they stop, and the person closest to them, they're supposed to, you know, project their emotions to that person non-verbally, you know, for instance, like two people could hug or just touch each other's faces. And Dawn is just kind of confused and like looks around and he's like not having any of it, and the woman he's, you know, interacting with basically just shoves him because of his very standoffish attitude. And it's really interesting because that's basically a microcosm of all of his relationships with his various mistresses. You know, is that, you
it
know,
makes sense.
It makes sense, you know, symbolism. So, and then eventually, you know, as you know, Stephanie has this really emotional day at a session, because in a previous season she, you know, gave birth to a boy and then basically gave him to her parent or mother and father-in-law to be with the father. And, you know, some people like fucking, what was her name? Was it Angie? Angie.
Yeah.
And I remember texting Casey like, God damn it, Angie. Because this one woman in the session basically, like, is like, that boy is going to grow up, like, very sad and without a mother. And, like, Stephanie obviously doesn't take this well. Dawn tries to comfort her, yada, yada. She can't take it. And then she's gone by the next day. And Dawn is stranded and distraught. And he doesn't know what to do. And then you have this episode, this finale has two heartbreaking phone calls. You know, you've got the one where he talks to Betty. I almost call her January Jones, but Betty. You know, at this point, Betty has been diagnosed with lung cancer, and she's completely accepted the fact that she's going to die, and she doesn't want treatment or anything. She's just trying to, you know, enjoy the last of her days. You know, and Don only now learns that she's dying and calls her up and is like, I'm coming to come there. I'm going to raise our sons, you know, and Sally, and just, you know, be the father. And she's like, no, you know, I want this to be as as normal as possible. I don't want anything, you know, new or confusing or exciting to happen. Because at this point, Don is very much, as a review put it, he's an aberration in his children's lives, not a constant.
Yeah.
Which is very true. And this is heartbreaking because he's basically told that he's not wanted in his children's lives. And but you can totally understand where Betty's coming from. And it's just... But at the same time, it's so like, you know, he's very emotional, like on the verge of crying. And so is she. And... it's probably the most like genuine emotional moment that you've seen between these two characters in years. And it's really heartbreaking and I love it. It's really great. And there's also like a theme of like, you know, what should you do? What shouldn't you do? And because in the seminars, they're also bringing up like, you know, shoulda, woulda, coulda, basically, you know?
Yeah,
there's lots of should-haves in life, or shoulds in life, but you can't just focus on those. And there's a lot of stuff that in this episode that Don's like, this is what I should do. This is what I should do. You know, I should go back and see Betty and be there when she dies and help my kids and all that kind of stuff. And so that's kind of a constant throughout the episode too. But then you have
you have the group therapy session. What is it that the guy says about, you know, what did I say about the word should?
Oh, I forget, but it's something like that. Like,
yeah.
Like basically don't use it.
Yeah.
As the paraphrase of it.
Yeah.
And then you have the second phone call. Well, actually it's a third phone call for Don. Fourth in the episode. Like I said, it's an episode of phone calls. Hence the title. But he calls Peggy. He calls the three most important women in his life. His daughter, his, you know, first ex-wife, and his protege.
Yeah.
And Peggy's is almost as emotional because at this point, Don is, like, on his last leg. He's so confused. He can't even, like, go on. And he calls her. And she's like, where have you been? Because he's been gone for weeks. You know, no one's heard from him. A lot of people think that he's dead, including his adorable secretary, Meredith. And you have this great scene where he basically just, you know, comes out with everything where it's like, I took a man's name. I scandalized my children. I've done nothing with this identity that I've been given. And she tries to console him, you know, because it's very clear, like, you know, I was talking about, like, the fear of Don killing himself. But this is probably like, I wonder if Matthew Weiner did this on purpose and just kind of teased that he's like very like defeatist and probably borderline suicidal at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And she just says like, you know, come home. Like that's what she says.
Yeah.
And then, you know, he says, What does he say? He says, like, I'll see you soon or something like that. It's not goodbye.
Yeah, he says, I'll see you soon.
Which is crazy, like, when you think about it, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, he basically just sits there, you know, defeated, doesn't know what to do. He doesn't even feel like he can get up. And then one of the instructors for the seminars kind of comes up and talks to him. He's like, why don't you come with me? And then he has this last session where, you know, people are talking about, and, like, this guy named Leonard talks about, you know, how he feels like he's extremely boring and no one gives a shit about him. And I actually brought up to Neil, I loved how he talks about this dream, Leonard does, and how he's basically on this shelf in the fridge, and how there's this party going on outside the fridge. And people keep opening the door to take stuff, you know, but they never take him. And it's like, I mentioned to Neil, like, isn't it interesting that basically sounds like part of a Coke ad? Like he's pitching,
kind of, sort of.
Like he's pitching a Coke ad to these people. Yeah.
He sounds more like mustard to me, but
I thought that was a great little bit too. And then you know, as the story goes on, Don basically realizes that he has someone he can relate to. He has someone that experiences himself. He's not alone in being lonely.
Yeah.
You know, and then he gives him this hug, and it's like, I want a hug from John Hamm after that scene.
Yeah, I really do. I feel like if John Hamm is going to submit a clip for the Academy or for the Emmys, it's probably going to be that scene. Like, he says so much without saying anything.
Exactly. And that's what's so great about him. Again, he's such an underrated actor. He really is.
Really is.
And so he kind of accepts this, and then, you know, then you kind of start this montage where you see everyone. You know, Joan, throughout this whole season, she has a really interesting season because it's like she's had huge highs and super lows. Like, she had this kind of boyfriend guy who was kind of a jerk, but not really. Like,
he was a jerk, but a lovable jerk.
Well, yeah, because it's like he was like, I don't want.
Really exciting.
Like, he was so excited about being retired, but then, you know, he meets this younger woman who has a child, and it's like he didn't know about her child. And so he's like, I don't want to be a part of this if I have to raise another kid. But then he comes back, and then Joan finds a new opportunity with Ken, you know, and Ken wants to kind of start this, like, possible production company for films, and he wants Joan in on it, and she wants to take part of it, which is really exciting, and I really love that idea.
Yeah.
I almost thought the show was going to end with, like aged Don Draper watching a movie produced by Peggy and Joan.
That would have been pretty great.
That would have been awesome, but then she comes back and her boyfriend guy kind of is like, you know, but you need to like I want to be a part of your life, but you're going to be so focused on this, blah, blah, blah. And he leaves. And it's such an interesting storyline to talk about because it lasts like 3 episodes or 4 episodes. Mm-hmm. Like, I almost wonder if he was introduced earlier in the season, what they would have done. But, man, what are you going to do? But she, you know, she moves forward. She's going to be producing films and stuff.
Yeah.
And, yeah, fucking Peggy and Stan hook up in the episode's 4th phone call, where they confess Peggy. Their love for each other, which...
Peggy and Stan find love.
Bah, 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 bah.
Ain't that great for them.
Ain't that great for them. And, like, me and Neil talked about it, we're like, we're both fine with it. I mean, it's almost like a scene that's, like, for the fans. It's like, here you go, guys. This one's for you.
But even then, it doesn't feel like it comes out of nowhere.
It doesn't come out of nowhere because they've had this, like kind of flirtatious relationship since season 4.
It's been flirtatious, but also very, like, antagonistic.
Yeah, but it's kind of... Isn't that the best relationships?
No.
Oh.
It's not.
Oh. You sure? What? You sure?
What?
That those aren't the best kind?
Oh, I mean, I guess. I mean, I guess they're pretty okay. I don't know.
I guess they're like okay.
I like my relationships where I love the other person.
Yeah, but they love each other, but then you know, you're poke fun at them.
Just hurling casual abuse at each other, right?
Yeah, and then, you know, get undressed in front of each other, and then, you know, confess that you had an illegitimate child that you gave up, and then blah, 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 whatever.
Sounds like 3/5 of my last relationship.
But yeah, you know, they edited together, and it's definitely the most, like, I guess you could call it corny part of this of the finale, but it's earned it. The show has earned it.
It's earned it, and the way the actors carry it off is just so good.
And because in the end, and then I guess we can get to the final part of the finale where...
We need to get to the final part.
We need to get to the final part where Don is in basically a meditation session, and he's listening to the instructor and talking about everything and being happy, and then, you know, you kind of zoom in on Don, and then he has a smile, and then you cut to I'd like to give the world a Coke.
Yeah.
Which, can I just say that as time has gone on, this ending has only felt more perfect.
Yes.
Because the only way you can really end Mad Men is with an advert, and arguably the most famous advert ever.
Yeah, aside from, like, Mean Joe Green, that is probably, like, one of the most... I would say that is probably the most famous advert of all time.
And it's, of course, implied that Don was the one that thought of this, using his newfound perspective from the retreat. And a lot of people, and to Neil's point about how you can interpret Don's actions multiple ways, some people think that this is very cynical in, like, a good way. Like, they appreciate it. Like, it's kind of black comedy, where it's, like, in the end, Don just kind of goes back. Well, he goes back to what makes him happy. You know, he's found happiness.
He goes back to basically the only home that would have him.
Which is McCann Erickson. And it's the only thing that really makes him happy, which is bringing happiness to others and pitching that to them in the form of advertisement.
Yeah. But a lot of people, some people view it as, you know, that's Don just giving up. Like, he doesn't achieve enlightenment. He just goes back to doing what he does. He just has, like, he's just there and he has a great idea. Like, and he's just going to use that idea and he's just going to go back on the same cycle. But I think that this really does apply to another thing about breaking the cycle with Don, where I don't think that it's necessarily that he hasn't learned anything. He hasn't learned anything, you know, in the course of that episode. He just has a good idea and he's like, well, back off to that. It feels like to me, and maybe this is just like, you know, with how everything's been going for me this past year, you know, like me trying to look on the bright side, but I do genuinely feel like Don achieved a form of, like, I guess, inner peace, like an understanding that, you know, everyone kind of shares this loneliness, some more than others, and that Don always felt that he was the only one, like that he was alone in feeling that loneliness, but then finding out that so many other people feel that same thing. So I guess he achieves this kind of peace about that, like learning that he's not alone.
Mm-hmm.
And then he applies that peace to, you know, creating that ad. Like, it's using what he's learned to push his craft forward.
Yeah.
And becoming, like, basically regaining his mojo.
And he's doing what he does best.
He's doing what he does best at probably, like, while, you know, bettering his life.
Yeah.
So I guess I have a little bit more of an optimistic spin on it. But then again, you know, you can go and take Matthew Weiner's words themselves, where Matthew Weiner clearly loves his characters and he wants to see good things happen to them. And not in, like, a non-conflict way. You know, I know some writers where it's like, I couldn't stand the thought of anything bad happening to my characters. It's like, that's why you'll suck as a writer.
It's like, haven't you heard the fucking theme of Kill Your Darlings?
Haven't you ever heard of the word conflict?
Yeah.
But like, it's clear that Weiner loves his characters and he wants to see them succeed. So that's why I apply the more optimistic filter to Don at the end. So,
and of course, everyone else is successful and happy, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So why should it just stop with Don?
Right.
That'd be shitty. That would suck. That'd be stupid. That's stupid.
You're stupid. We're all stupid.
You ever seen Jello Apocalypse's videos on YouTube? There's one that's like, welcome to YouTube. There's either welcome to YouTube or welcome to Facebook. And it's like, you know, something like, you know, like, that's stupid. You're stupid.
Yeah.
I'll send it to you.
But anyway, well, I mean, and that basically wraps up the finale. Like, what would you give it overall, Neil? Like, the finale. What would be your arbitrary rating?
Arbitrary ratings. I'd give... I'd give it 9.5, 10 suitcases out of 10. There you go.
Holy shit, man.
It's such a satisfying finale.
It's satisfying.
It's satisfying that doesn't feel like a cheat.
And it doesn't tell you too much. Like, you don't need to have, like a 6 feet under kind of ending.
Yeah, you don't need to see everyone fucking die.
Yeah, and, like, see the rest of their lives.
You don't need any of that. Yeah, set to a Sia song.
Yeah.
You don't need any of that. You get where everyone is at right now, and it feels satisfying.
And it's left open-ended enough.
It doesn't involve Don Draper, like, looking up into the sky, and then, like, the camera going up, and then finding out that, you know, New York and McCann Erickson and whatnot was all just in a snow globe held by an autistic boy.
Named Donald Draper.
It doesn't have, like, Don Draper waking up, you know, in bed after a horrible dream with, like, Rachel, the girl from the first season, sleeping right next to him.
It's like the same, it's like the first episode. So yeah. The entire show is, like, a really awful, like, fever dream.
Yeah.
Oh, Don, like, honey, you had such awful food poisoning.
It's not Don Draper, you know.
I shouldn't have eaten that much Burger Chef.
It's not Don Draper waking up and being, like, a lumberjack or something, you know. You don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, I would definitely... I would give it 9 bottles of Coke out of 10.
Yeah, there you go.
There you go. And I guess we could just kind of wrap with, like, our overall thoughts on the show and just,
It's the beginning. It's the gold standard of the second age of the second golden era of television.
And probably besides The Sopranos.
Well, The Sopranos launched the first one. I would say Mad Men launched the second one.
Well, so what was part of the first one? Would you say the first wave?
The Sopranos.
The Sopranos and what else? Like The Wire.
Yeah, The Wire, Sopranos, like basically HBO kickstarted it. I would dare say that AMC kickstarted the second one.
Okay. Yeah.
Which is kind of sad because then you look at the rest of AMC's output and it's like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Oh, what happened, guys?
Hey, man, I was the one guy that both liked and watched Low Winter Sun.
Oh, you're that guy.
Yeah, that one guy, you know, where the rating said it was like 0.000001.
One person is watching this. One single solitary person.
One single person.
This.
And they're not even in Detroit where this show takes place. But I think Mad Men's significance, like kind of to repeat what I said earlier, is like I think it's really underrated and underplayed how significant the show was. Without the show, I don't know if we'd have Breaking Bad, maybe, but you know, who knows? If they would have without the success of Mad Men, I don't know if they would have necessarily taken a chance on Breaking Bad? Like, I don't know.
It's a good question. I think that AMC would have done it anyways because they were trying to expand their repertoire.
Yeah. But I don't know if they would have necessarily known how to handle it.
Yeah.
You know? And, of course, I don't think The Walking Dead would have happened at all.
Well, I think The Walking Dead had been in development for a while. I think just AMC was just like, yeah, fuck it, just send it over here. Like, Mad Men and Breaking Bad were both supposed to go to either, like, HBO or something else, and they got rejected, and so AMC was like, eh, we'll take it.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's necessarily the case with The Walking Dead, but it comes close.
But it should also be mentioned that, you know, it's also a first in the fact that it's the first ever, you know, cable drama show to win Best Drama. Yeah, and it's a really great show. It appealed to me on so many levels, you know, both just it was basically firing all cylinders in every way, acting, writing, directing, you know, music, set design, costumes.
It's all top tier.
Everything. And you know, it definitely deserves to be considered one of the greatest shows of all time, and it was, you know, and I'm not saying like there may not be one that comes back later on that may supplant it as such, but it is my favorite show, like my favorite drama that I've ever had the pleasure of watching.
Still the wire for me, but Mad Men comes really close.
Wow, gotta just fucking shoot that down, Neil. Well,
yeah, of course. Well, you know, you know me. I'm a whore for The Wire.
You are a whore, and you like The Wire.
It's true. I can like both things.
Those two very unrelated things.
Neil likes cuddling for money.
You know, and I think if you haven't seen Mad Men, I don't know if you've made it this far with all the spoilers and stuff, but.
Why would you be listening to this unless you just wanted to hear us talk? Which, I mean, I get it.
Which, yeah, we get it, I guess. But if you haven't given Mad Men a shot, like, keep in mind, it's like, I would argue that it's probably got some of the best feministic messages and characters.
Well, without beating you over the head with, like, sexism is wrong, it's just like, just show this and make it, like, make your own decision for it, and which is usually, yeah, this is wrong.
Well, yeah, and
it puts faith in you, the viewer, to be able to say, like, yeah, that's not
like
that's
if
not
you
okay.
If you want really strong female characters, watch fucking Mad Men. You know, yeah. I remember
Steven and I were at a TV fest in Atlanta, SCAT Atlanta, in 2013, and there was this girl that we came across who had never seen Mad Men, and we were talking about, like, you know, we were saying, like, dude, you should really watch Mad Men because she was a writer. You know, it's like, why would she not watch Mad Men? And she was saying, like, well, you know, I don't think I get past the sexism. It's like, okay.
But you realize that the sexism is there because it actually happened. It's
yeah,
not gonna...
and you realize that the show is not endorsing sexism. It is just depicting it. It actually is a smart show that relies on you, the viewer, to be able to make decisions on your own to say, this is wrong.
This isn't fucking Pan Am where they have a black woman be a flight a flight attendant, even though that wouldn't fucking happen.
That wouldn't have happened until like 10 years later.
Exactly. So,
but it's like, you gotta pander. And it's like, ugh.
Well, yeah, you gotta like just fucking erase history and, you know, just kind of ignore the fact that racism was the thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's really insulting. Yeah. Yeah, if anything, Mad Men is important for just all the fucking shows it spawned that were exactly like it, or at least trying to be, but they never hit.
Yeah.
They never hit it.
Well,
it's just like Game of Thrones. Like, everything wants to be Game of Thrones, but none of them are Game of Thrones because they all miss the point mm-hmm. of why it is the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
What makes it so special. But anyway, sorry, that's just me. Yeah, Mad Men, great depiction of feminism. There you go.
It is like some of the best female characters and best characters in general.
Peggy Olson for the win.
Peggy Olson, man. Like if you are a feminist, if you're a woman who is just craving a really awesome female character to follow and you haven't watched Mad Men, change that.
Yeah.
You know, her and Joan, because Joan has just as great of an arc as Peggy does. Because
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, just because, you know, Joan starts basically being like a servant to like the misogynistic, you know, environment, you know,
yeah.
And then she realizes how bullshit it is. And then by the series end, she's basically becoming a producer for films.
Yeah.
So, fuck.
one of the things that I really appreciate about Mad Men is that there's this weird idea now that especially with like characters like minority characters or female characters, that, you know, like with male characters, you know, they're all just their characters, that's it. But when you have like a female character or a minority character, somehow that female or minority character is supposed to represent all females or all minorities in that one character, which is not how that works.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I love Peggy and I love Joan, but Peggy is kind of abrasive a lot of times.
Yes, she is.
She's really abrasive. And Joan, her emotions turn at the flip of a switch.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Joan
is
very...
Well, they're flawed characters, and that's
exactly.
what... Exactly. And that's about as feminist as you can get, because you're showing women as real
people.
Human beings.
That's one of the things that I love about them. It's not the fact that people... Like, you know, Peggy does not represent all women. Joan does not represent all women. That's not how that works.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of the things that I really appreciate about that is like, I would probably be friends with Joan in real life. I don't know if I'd be friends with Peggy, but I still find them both endlessly fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things I love about Mad Men is that it kind of, I don't want to say it puts to rest the idea that, you know, all female characters must be representative of all females. Like, they're just as flawed as the male characters.
Yeah.
And that to me is true equality.
Yeah.
That's what you should strive for.
And to continue on just talking about the characters real quick before we wrap up is just, I feel like these, like, you know, you spend so much time, 8 years with these characters, and it's just like, you feel a huge connection to them, you know, like they're not real people, but you feel like you could, like you just said, like you could have, you know, you could be friends with Joan. Like, you want to, like, be with these characters because you've been with them for so long, you know?
Yeah.
And I think few shows have done that for me, like, the way Mad Men has. Like, I've grown up with these characters.
Yeah.
And I feel better for having seen these characters, having known these characters. And, you know, it's just been one hell of a ride, and it's, you know, it's going to suck not having Mad Men to come back to in a year. You know, it's just...
It's okay. It's okay. We'll always have Game of Thrones and Better Call Saul.
But those are different shows. Those are different.
Shut your whore mouth, Taylor.
Well, but like half of Game of Thrones cast is like assholes and murderers. And
yeah, I know. Yeah, because all the people in Mad Men were totally agreeable to...
Well, I'm just saying, but they weren't like fucking murderers most of the time.
Most of the time.
But I think that pretty much wraps it up, Neil. And, you know, yeah. I wanted to, like, I know I've been talking about happiness, and I wanted to kind of read this quote that Don says, like, just to kind of bring it all around and what the show was really about. Go, you know, rewind all the way back to Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, which is the pilot. And Don's trying to, you know, pitch Lucky Strike to the people. and he talks about advertising, and it's like advertising is based on one thing, happiness. And do you know what happiness is? Happiness is the smell of a new car. It's freedom from fear. It's a billboard on the side of the road that screams with a reassurance that whatever you're doing is okay. You are okay. And there is basically, in the first episode, foreshadowing what happens in the last episode.
You could almost say that it begins with a very strong topic sentence.
Basically. Yeah. Matthew Weiner just had a really good thesis.
Yeah.
At the beginning of his script. So
now the show is gone and we are sad men.
Weiner.
Mad Max, Mad Max, I saw Mad Max, go see Mad Max.
Well, thanks for joining me, Neil, and thank you, absolutely, listeners, for joining us.
I feel honored. I remember when we used to do, you know, recaps of Mad Men way back in the day, back like 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, I get to be here for the last Mad Men recap, so yeah, I feel like, really special about
that. That's something that I really want to do, because, you know, we hadn't done a just you and me review in a long time, so.
Yeah, I know. I was just on last week. That's really weird. This is the most I've been on in a while.
Yeah, but I mean, this is just you and me. So, anyway.
Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Channel.
Anyway, say goodnight, Neil.
Goodnight, Neil.
I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love. Grow apple trees and honey.